From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Thursday when President Joe Biden signed an executive order relating to higher education and the pandemic. According to a piece published by Inside Higher Ed, the order directs the Department of Education to develop safer schools and campuses' best practices clearinghouse to share information about reopening safely. The department would also be required to develop evidence-based guidelines for reopening, taking school settings, resources, and population into account. Campuses across the country have already taken different approaches to reopening based on individual circumstances. Stanford University scrapped plans to have freshmen and sophomores back on campus in person after more than 40 students tested positive for the virus. Goucher College in Maryland will remain online this semester, while other colleges, including several in Rochester, will offer a combination of in-person and remote learning, some with delayed semester start dates or shortened terms. This hour, we explore how local institutions are handling reopening. We'll talk about course formats, testing protocol, dorm life, what they can expect of students who are back on campus, and what college leaders want to see from the federal government in terms of support. I'd like to welcome our guests now. Beth Paul is the president of Nazareth College. President Paul, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks so much. Thanks for including me.
You got it. Catherine Douglas, interim president of MCC, Monroe Community College. President Douglas, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Evan. Please call me Kate.
You got it, Kate. And Jeff Runner, Dean of the College of Arts, Sciences, and Engineering at the University of Rochester. Dean Runner, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me ask all three of you just to kind of set the landscape for listeners right out of the gate here. I mean, we're heading into February, and you know we've seen the winter surge in cases. There is some hope that we are on the downtrend, but there's also concern about new variants that spread more easily of this virus. Beth Paul, I'll start with you at Nazareth College. What is the plan there?
We have postponed the start of our spring semester to February 1st. So our residence halls open at 10 a.m. on Saturday, and we are very much eager to have our students return. We do have a return testing requirement. All of our students have to return with a test that shows a negative result. If there is a positive result, and then they go into quarantine and are tested again. And then we're going to test our entire population, all student, faculty, and staff, upon returning. So during the first week, we will test everyone. Our feeling is that we need a clean start. It's really important for us to have as clean a start as we can. And then we continue all of the protocols that we have in place from the fall that worked very well for us in the fall. So all of those safe behavior protocols will continue.
And when it comes to what you did learn from the fall, what stands out as number one for sort of maintaining a healthy and safe campus?
You know, first and foremost is a spirit of community and a spirit of responsibility for one another. That's very strong in our community, and I was really proud of our students for taking great responsibility for themselves as well as each other. We recognize, especially coming into spring, that one of the riskiest pieces of any of our lives is dining and the ability to wear masks in that kind of setting. So we're trying to take some additional precautions by advising students on how they can keep masks on when they're sitting at a dining table and just having conversation. Keep your masks on. Try to be a little more careful with that kind of behavior. But generally, our students performed very, very well, and we're excited to have them back, and I know they're eager to be back.
Sure. And just briefly, when it comes to testing, requiring a test, are we talking about a possible rapid test? Are we talking about, the deeper nasal swab? What is the expectation?
In the first week back, we will use the rapid test for testing everyone in our community. And then as we proceed through the spring semester, we will have weekly surveillance testing with a percentage of our population, and that will also be using the rapid test. Anytime there is a positive test result with the rapid test, the student then, or faculty or staff member, then proceeds to having the PCR test.
Got it. Okay. Kate Douglas, let's talk about MCC. How's it going there?
Well, we are welcoming students back this week, actually, Evan, and we're thrilled to have them. Our semester is starting on schedule. We are continuing our approach, which also was very successful in the fall, of having a conservative approach with a minimal amount of on-campus face-to-face learning dictated by our faculty in terms of those courses that and content that require face-to-face, you know, things like our nursing program, our welding program, our auto tech, our dental. So those students are back face-to-face, and they, too, have 100% daily assessments to be on campus along with our faculty and staff, and 100% of our students will weekly test. Monday, we tested over 800 folks and then another 400 on Tuesday, so we're geared up and ready to go. And we're continuing that, you know, low social, low campus density, and then the personal protective equipment, the socially distance, the testing, tracing, and isolating if necessary. In the fall, we tested well over 5,000 individuals in our biweekly tests, which is what we did last semester. We're shifting to weekly now in the spring. And we had less than a 0.3% positivity rate. So, you know, we were lower than the county rate, lower than the New York rate. And like Dr. Paul, our students are very compliant. They want to be on campus. They want to be learning. And they're very interested in being compliant. So we're grateful for that. In the spring, we're also delighted to be able to welcome our athletes back to return to competition for their spring sports come April. So we'll be doing, again, very close monitoring of testing and assessment and, if necessary, tracing and isolating.
When it comes to testing, is everyone on board? Any complaints?
Oh, there's the occasional concern about what is this, how does it work, but we've been able to accommodate any individuals that have questions, and we're using the Upstate Medical pool testing approach, Evan, that is was approved by the FDA, and so that pool testing has been very successful for us.
And let me also ask you what I asked President Paul. When you look at what we have learned, especially since September, what stands out the most to you as a strategy or a requirement to make sure that you can continue to do what you need to do at MCC and do it safely?
My answer would really be the conservative approach that we took. We learned some lessons in terms of how important that is. We're maintaining that this spring, expanding it in slightly different ways, but again, starting slow. For example, one of the things that we've seen is that even after this pandemic is done, Evan, we anticipate our students are going to be interested in more flexibility. And so we've piloted this spring semester with a group of faculty who have volunteered to pilot high flex courses. So these are courses that they will be delivered in three modes, and that is there'll be a small socially distant group face-to-face with the instructor in the room. It will also be synchronously offered on Zoom for students, and it will be recorded so that students who are unable to be synchronously either in person or on Zoom can watch that and then be ready for the next class. So we're, again, starting small, starting conservatively, but stretching out to new ways that we think will serve our students in the future.
Dean Renner, what's the landscape look like at the University of Rochester?
Sure, I can echo a lot of what Kate and Beth both shared in terms of keeping very conservative in how we're doing things. For us, we have a number of students who come from out of state and out of country, so we have an additional challenge of the students who are not from adjacent states. When they come back to campus, they need to first demonstrate that they have been tested and that they're negative, go into quarantine for 3 days, and then when they come out, they need to test again and be negative, and then they move into the residence halls. We're very thankful for the help of some of the local hotels who are helping us with the with housing the students when they're in the travel quarantine. Students who are coming from local areas, the states adjacent to New York. They will all be tested as well when they come to campus before moving in. Students who don't live on campus, so we have about, I would say, about 70% of our students living on campus. Those students who are not living on campus will be able to get tested. We are not mandating it. We will, in terms of the types of tests, in the fall, we did the PCR tests regularly. We had surveillance tests, about 400 students per week, which was a smallish number this semester. Now that we have the rapid tests, we're going to be doing about 2,000 tests per week and cycling through all of the students. We, in the cases of the rapid tests, if we ever get a false positive or a positive, we immediately then run the PCR test, which is really the gold standard to determine whether the student really is positive. We've managed to, for managing cases, and we've had really relatively few positives over the fall semester. We also had very, very low rates, much like the other speakers. What we have done is use some of our unoccupied on-campus apartments for isolation and quarantine, and that has been a real group effort. There's a group of dedicated staff who both try to set up those spaces so they're very comfortable, plus also be available to answer questions, provide food, and things like that.
Are you feeling, Jeff, that, you know, I mean, anybody, I think, would feel like you've learned a lot since September, since the fall here. But are you feeling that some of the decisions that, you know, were frankly questioned, and understandably so by some of the harshest critics of reopening, that a lot of those questions, do you feel like they've been answered adequately on how to do this?
Yeah, I mean, so throughout the fall, our numbers were much lower than the surrounding community, especially going into winter. We still had about 400 or 500 students living on campus. And we had, you know, pretty much zero positive cases on campus over the winter stay. We call it winter stay, even though, as you know, the Monroe County was serious, having a peak. So we feel that we have done a good job, that the campus itself is a pretty safe environment. Our students, as the others have mentioned, we're very compliant. They want to be here. They really, really want to be here. And no student wants to be the one that messes it up for everyone. They want to, so they're very compliant. Everyone wears masks everywhere in public. We had a pretty conservative visitor policy for students living in the residence halls. Nobody is allowed to visit anyone in another residence hall. And actually, people are not even able to visit each other in their rooms. Only people that share a room or share a suite are able to visit each other. We do have lounges on the hall, so students can get together. We've also set up a number of classrooms that can be used for studying in safe ways to deal with the need for students to be able to interact. It's been a kind of a balancing act, and I'm sure that Beth and Kate can also comment on this. We want our students to be physically safe, healthy, and safe, right? But at the same time, we also have to think about their mental health. And part of being in college, people are away from home. Part of being in college is actually the socializing and the being able to do things with peers. And that's something that we've really had to restrict. So it's been a kind of a balancing act to make sure that we're both addressing the physical health of our students, but also the mental health of our students.
Sure. And listeners, if you've got questions, comments about higher ed, colleges, universities, community colleges, and the like reopening and how they're handling the reopening plans, you can call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Or email us, connections@WXXI.org. You can email me, as some listeners do, at edawson@WXXI.org. But if you do connections@WXXI.org, it'll get to both myself and producer Megan Mack, and we'll make sure we try to get your comments on air when we can here. And AJ sends me a note asking, well, AJ says, you cannot stop college kids from partying, but are these schools even trying? Well, Jeff, let me start with you on that, because I'm laughing. I mean, I don't mean to laugh. I understand right now large gatherings are a problem in a pandemic. But one of the points that you were making is that students are sort of keenly aware of the consequences if things go wrong here. So what would you say to AJ, who feels like, you know, colleges are an epicenter of partying and group spread?
I understand that perspective, and of course that's true at some level, because that's one of the reasons students come to college. They want to be able to socialize and get together with their friends. But as I mentioned, the students are really kind of watching each other, I have to say. And I won't say there were no parties. I won't say there were no gatherings that were not within our guidelines. But we did, put together a website where students could actually submit what we call COVID concerns. And this could be anything from, you know, I'm concerned that I'm not seeing people wearing masks, or, you know, I'm in this class and one of my colleagues doesn't socially distance, or things like that. And when there were cases with get-togethers that we wouldn't have sanctioned, we found out about it. And although we want to create a learning environment, we tended to use this as an opportunity for education. We would follow up on those cases and make sure that students understand really how important it was and how dangerous it was.
Okay. President Paul at Nazareth College, what would you say to AJ after that email?
You know, I agree with Jeff very strongly. It's so important for our students to have opportunities to be part of community and to be with one another, and really important for their mental health. I think we're all feeling that. You know, what we tried to do early on, we were very sensitive to just giving messages of you can't, you can't, you can't. And so very early on, we tried to get very creative about what you can do. And so how do we create different opportunities for students to interact with one another, but in a safer way, in smaller groups, oftentimes, you know, through virtual means? And so we have had a vast array of kinds of activities for students to engage in. And it's really been wonderful because, of course, we've continued it over the break. So even as the students weren't here, we were creating community for them, everything from, you know, online yoga courses to a flash forum, you know, the day after the riot at the Capitol. So, you know, we've been trying to be more proactive about helping them to find positive ways to create so that they are not as interested in the riskier behaviors.
Okay. And Kate Douglas, I know it's a little bit of a different situation at Monroe Community College, but how do you view this issue?
Well, it's similar to Jeff and Beth. You know, our students really do want to comply. But, you know, I will say we had to manage some outside the bounds. And we did, like Jeff reported, use it as an opportunity for education and to help people understand why it's so important. And I have to give a big shout out to our student service professionals here at Monroe Community College. They have been so incredibly creative in terms of ways to safely keep students engaged, to support community. I went to a virtual murder mystery dinner that was just amazing. The students were fully engaged. I didn't know who done it. And it was all, it's just an example of how our student services folks prioritize engagement, prioritize developing a sense of community, but are being challenged to do it in a safe way, in a virtual way, and they're figuring it out.
Wow. Let me address then some of the points that our guests have made, and Kate Douglas was talking about high flex courses. There are some questions about how many students are actually back on campus or what the classes look like. So Angela says, these are expensive institutions. How many classes are fully remote? Are the students allowed back in physical classrooms? Let me start with Kate Douglas on that. You mentioned high flex courses. Do you have a breakdown of, roughly what percentage of classes are one way or another right now?
Yeah, we have roughly about 25% of our course sections are being delivered with some element of face-to-face. So that's not every week for some courses. Again, faculty-driven. A biology faculty member might have decided, you know, there are four essential labs that have to be face-to-face. Others can be done, in his or her opinion, online. And so those students come back only four times over the course of the semester, whereas our dental students are here, you know, every week. So it varies. So it's about 25%, about a quarter of our sections are being delivered with some element of face-to-face. And then the remote can be anything from, you know, a Zoom class to an online class to hybrid, to the traditional, you come to campus every time. So we really, our faculty have stepped up in a huge way and have really added technology to how they do things. You know, I do a thing where I get together with small groups of either students or faculty or staff and have a Zoom meeting and get caught up on what's happening. And I had one last week with faculty and staff, and to an individual, they spoke about how this pandemic has pushed them to figure out how to use technology in new ways that are engaging and accessible for students. And those that will stay with us, I believe, Evan, after this pandemic. Those creative ways that we are meeting students' needs with technology, I think that will be part of the legacy that this pandemic leaves within higher education.
Hmm. Jeff Runner, do you have a sense for how the University of Rochester is breaking down remote versus, you know, some sort of a hybrid or in-person?
Sure. I'm in art sciences and engineering, but I can speak to art sciences and engineering. I could say a little bit about Eastman. For us, it's about 50% of our classes have some in-person component. Our situation is a little complicated because we have so many students who are international. And as you know, there have been so many challenge restrictions over the past year, given the disease, given some of the political climate, that we have had to make sure that every single course is available remotely. So we have students in China, for example, that have our full-time students taking their classes remotely. This puts a tremendous amount of pressure on our faculty because they need to develop courses that are both have the ability to be taken remotely, but also for those who are doing it in person, they are doing essentially a high flex model as well, where they're having some lectures maybe in person, but also recorded, or there's maybe pre-recorded lectures and then in class activities, or labs or things like that. And so for us, as I said, it's about 50-50. I know at Eastman, what they did was prioritized music making. So many of the students there, of course, are very much interested in making music. And what they did for that was all of the music making activities would be in person if there was space available, whereas some of the more curricular classes, academic classes, would be in online format. So they sort of treated it a little differently, recognizing what their real, you know, what the main focus of that is. I think for some of our other schools, it really varied. The med school and the nursing school had sort of a mix. Warner School, which is our education grad school, they went completely online. So they developed a whole remote curriculum.
Hmm. And President Paul, same question for Nazareth.
The majority of our classes have in-person learning, and it's a really important part of who we are. So we've done things like thin out the classrooms. You know, we have labs that may have had 30 students in them now have 15, or, you know, we've thinned things out so that there is more distance and safety in the classroom. But the vast majority of our courses are in person and do include significant in-person components, even if there are some online components as well. Probably about 20% of our courses are more online. So the other piece of our learning experience that is so critical to who we are is experiential learning. And we have students who are in various kinds of learning experiences all throughout the Rochester community. And these are learning experiences that have an impact on our community. And so that impact doesn't stop in a pandemic. In fact, in many ways, it gets greater. So our students have continued with our practica and internships and different kinds of experiential learning experiences throughout Rochester by adhering to whatever the safety protocols are of the organization or agency or business that they are taking part in. And so that kind of learning, we think, has been critical to continue, but we've had to be very creative to help that continue. But our students really want to be engaged, and they want to be, you know, have that face-to-face more, the closer experience. So they've worked hard to allow us to continue to do it.
Well, and I think, you know, looking a little more deeply into what is at the root of Angela's email, there seems to be a concern that, you know, if students and their families are going to spend significantly on higher ed, sometimes taking out loans, that they ought to be getting the best possible education. And I know that there was some debate last summer as we headed for the fall about whether there was a way to do education well remotely. Now, certainly some classes you really can't do remotely, hardly at all. Some you can do mostly remotely or fully remotely. I think most people would agree that an in-person experience is still more direct and engaged and, for lack of a better term, better. But it's interesting. I mean, Kate Douglas, maybe I'll start with you on this. I want to ask all three of you. I mean, you said that there are certain changes that will carry beyond the pandemic here. And one of them is a little bit more flexibility here. For the cynics who hear that and think, well, that just means more remote learning and remote learning is not good. Can you maybe elaborate or clarify on that?
I'd be happy to. Let me give an example of something that we actually started to pilot last February, so it was before the pandemic. One of the things that we know as educators is that students succeed and persist better when they are engaged in study groups. I mean, nursing is the quintessential example of students who form study groups outside of class, and it helps them perform in class. And so we started piloting with an app called Circle In. And Circle In is a gaming app for encouraging study groups. And we thought we'd give it a try, approved it last February, and then came March of 2020, and we went all remote. And it was our first semester trying Circle In. We have now three semesters of data on that, Evan, from spring to summer to fall of 2020, and each semester more students used it, more students succeeded, more students persisted. And so while we still look forward to when we can have more face-to-face safely, we can say that things like Circle In, it's a gaming app. Students earn points for assisting others to learn content in the class, and then they can turn those points in for prizes at the end. And what we saw is that as it built momentum, it's definitely helped students succeed. So while technology isn't the answer to all of higher education's future, it certainly can deliver quality experiences that are more accessible to more students and ultimately have more students succeed.
Okay. President Beth Paul at Nazareth, what are some of the changes that you've had to make that might stay with you post-pandemic?
You know, the primary change is that our toolboxes have gotten bigger. So our faculty have learned all sorts of new and different ways to connect with students and to help our students to learn. And that bigger toolbox allows us to be more dynamic in our learning. So as Kate, I think, has described very well, there's some kinds of learning that can happen and, in fact, can happen in unique ways with technology. So, for example, we have a very big Fulbright program as well as other study abroad experiences, and you know, many of those couldn't happen during this time. But that didn't stop us from giving students really interesting international experiences. So collaborations, for example, a Shark Tank competition that was between an institution in Australia and an institute and a class here at Nazareth. And they partnered together through the whole semester in intermingled teams and then had a Shark Tank competition together. So things like that, very creative solutions that do, you know, use technology to actually expand experiences. But what you find with a more diversified toolbox is that some kinds of learning are best achieved in one way than another. And that's what this greater versatility allows us in our learning community.
Hmm. And Dean Runner at the University of Rochester, what stays post-pandemic?
Yeah, I want to echo the same thing. One thing that was, you know, this need to create a high flex classroom or an online classroom, really, it motivated our faculty to sort of think, well, what are the core learning outcomes that I want from this course, and how can I actually think about these explicitly given the new tools that I'm working with? And I think it's been actually really invigorating for faculty to sort of rethink how they're trying to deliver what they're trying to deliver. And if anything, I'm thinking that this is going to ultimately result in better education, better teaching, better better opportunities for our students. One of the things I want to say is earlier there was a comment about you know, whether we're going to just stick to everything being online. I mean, for us, for certain, we're a residential experience. Our students come here in the normal case and live here. And I always talk about how our students are with us 24/7, not just when they're in the classroom. And it's our responsibility to create opportunities for them to grow and learn both inside the classroom and outside the classroom. So like was mentioned earlier, it's really important for us to create experiential learning opportunities for students to get a chance to have leadership opportunities, to get to know how to work together. All of these things that are important when they leave us and they enter the workforce, that they've developed not only the sort of academic skills that they learn in a classroom, but they've also learned how to work with one another and learn some of those soft skills that you only learn by really interacting with one another in a campus community. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I want to mention, you know, U of R, one of the reasons students come to U of R is because we are a top research university and our faculty are top researchers in their areas. So one of the benefits of being a student at the University of Rochester, whether you're in a classroom or whether you're taking a class remotely, is that you're interacting with some of the top scholars in their fields across a whole array of areas. And that's really part of, you know, what we think is important, and that hasn't changed. The method of interaction may have changed a bit, but if we're doing this right and we're really trying to, the students are still getting inspired by these inspiring professors, and they're getting lots of opportunities to do research and other things as well.
Well, and as we go to break here, Randy emails to say, Evan, I applaud your guests for keeping the students safe, thereby allowing them to have the on-campus experience. I attended three different colleges to obtain all of my degrees, and each campus had a different vibe. They were all wonderful. I can't imagine having to go to college from either my parents' home or from some apartment in another city. The on-campus experience is an incredible growth opportunity to interact with students and faculty from all different backgrounds and stripes. Looking back so many years, I realize only now how much I truly cherished the on-campus college experience. That's from Randy. I mean, I certainly... I agree with you in my own experience, Randy. I'm with you. I will also just say students have proven at all ages in the last 10, 11, 12 months how adaptable they are. But we're all looking forward to a post-pandemic world. And we're talking to some of the leaders of local institutions about how they are handling this pandemic winter. Beth Paul is the president of Nazareth College. Kate Douglas, the interim president of Monroe Community College. Jeff Runner, the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Engineering at the University of Rochester, all with us. Answering more of your questions, including Mark asking, how do they contact Trace? Have they had to do a lot of that? We'll ask them on the other side of this break. Coming up in our second hour, astrophysicist Adam Frank joins us, talking about the way science has unified the country in a divided time, with vaccines saving lives in record speed and giving us a path out of the pandemic. But that's not all. Adam will talk to us about a project that he's part of, collaborators across the country working on giant lasers that recreate the inner workings of alien worlds. Why? Wait till you find out next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Mark's wondering, how do you contact Trace? Have you had to do a lot of that? President Beth Paul at Nazareth, what do you think?
We certainly have, and we have been a community in doing it, I have to say. So for contact tracing, several staff as well as a group of students have been trained by Johns Hopkins Medical Center in contact tracing methodology. And so that team has acted very, very quickly. And I would say, and I'm sure my colleagues would agree, it is the quick response that is effective. So I've been really proud of our students. This is hard, if you can imagine. You know, a student who is, you know, test positive and then all of a sudden has to think about who I've been with, you know, in the last, you know, several days, and to be able to report that. And it takes some courage, I think, to do that. But again, it's a sense of collective community responsibility. So as an example, we had a time in the middle of the fall where all of a sudden we had a little spike in cases, and we immediately were able to do contact tracing to isolate those who had tested positive and to quarantine, and it nipped it in the bud. It was very, very successful and very effective. So the immediacy, the quick action, and again, I really appreciate all of my colleagues here in that responsible work, as well as the students in taking community responsibility and doing so.
And President Paul, have there been any days or moments where you thought, oh man, you know, looks like we are on the verge of something, you know, some sort of spreadable event or an outbreak? Have there been anything like that?
We definitely had an experience in the fall, and it is the one that I'm talking about, actually. We had an experience in the fall that almost came out of, you know, left field. We knew eventually that it was traced back to an event, but it was sudden, and it happens quickly. So to be able to act quickly, you know, to be ready with the contact tracers and to be able to act very quickly with isolation and quarantine space, which we have on hand at all times, that's really the magic. Otherwise, we've really done well in terms of managing. Knock on wood. I knock on a lot of wood these days.
No, and I'm with you, President Paul. I mean, when it comes to the speed, the need for speed to not only deal with the virus, but just to get students or really any human being to trace where they have been. If somebody asked me, where were you 4 days ago? I mean, I could maybe do it. I mean, how about 3 weeks ago? I mean, it's almost impossible. What day did you go to the store 3 weeks ago? It's very, very difficult if you don't start moving quickly. So I certainly take that point. Jeff Runner, can you build on that? What's it been like at the U of R?
We also have had to use contact tracing a number of different times. We have a team that is made up of staff in our University Health Services that does the contact tracing combined with effort from the county as well. It's kind of interesting because I don't think I always thought, you know, if we have a COVID positive student or two COVID positive students, that's sort of the end of the story. That's not the end of the story, because for every positive student, there's maybe three or five additional people that they interacted with over the previous couple days. So when we're thinking about creating what we call Q&I, quarantine and isolation space, we have to be thinking not just about the student that tests positive, but all of those people that they may have interacted with. We also have been very, very lucky. I had mentioned that we had very low numbers of positive cases, but we did end up using our quarantine and isolation space because quite often that one positive might result in three or four what we might think of as exposures. We've been really lucky that a lot of times those exposures turned out just to be negatives and they never ended up developing the disease. But with the being cautious, of course, we isolate everyone who is exposed to the person that tests positive.
Okay. And Kate Douglas at MCC.
Yes, I would echo the same things, Evan. What I can add is, yes, we are definitely, we trained our entire health services staff through the Johns Hopkins contact tracing, so they do that. But we also, as Jeff mentioned, we collaborate closely with the Monroe County Department of Public Health because we have many commuter students and our faculty and staff commute. And so we work closely with them, and they do the contact tracing on Monroe County residents, and we do the contact tracing for residential students. But I wanted to give an example of in our, you know, we also have childcare on our campus. And throughout this entire pandemic since last month, March, we've maintained our capacity to support childcare because many of the children who come to our childcare are children of healthcare workers. And so we want to be able to support them to continue to do their job. But you can imagine if a healthcare worker has a child in our childcare center, it's likely that they're coming in some level of exposure to the virus. And that is exactly where we saw our first case. And that was, the child of a healthcare worker. And what I can say is the entire staff and all of the parents and children were incredibly cooperative and helpful to make sure that, okay, we have to do, we have to close for a few days. We have to bring in all the sanitation and cleaning. We have to escort our public safety, escorted the mom and her child back to their apartment. We were ensured that family had all the supplies that they needed so that they could continue to quarantine in terms of food and baby supplies. So it was a real team effort, and that has been the watchword of all our contact tracing is as we contact students or employees to let them know, I would say almost most of the time they have no idea where they got it. and so you're really trying to, you know, piece together like a detective. Well, let's think of where you were and and who else we have to contact. But in the case of our childcare positive case, it was an easy one because the parent worked in healthcare right here in Rochester, and that's where the exposure came. But we really came together as a community, as Beth is saying, to make sure that those folks are safe. Fortunately, both mom and child are fine, but also all the other parents and families in that childcare center, along with that staff, wanted to make sure, how do we keep each other safe? And they were very cooperative and very compliant.
And well, Evan, I have to say, I think all of us owe a shout out to the Monroe County Public Health Department and Dr. Michael Mendoza and his team. It's extraordinary. And the very close partnership we have, we couldn't be doing this without them. So we all owe a shout out there.
Amen.
Question from a listener on Twitter. When will alumni at Nazareth have access to the facilities again? Library, fitness center, et cetera. President Paul?
As soon as we can. We have been so careful. We have been trying to be, as you can imagine, you know, we've been trying to limit access as much as we can so that we can prioritize the learning of our students. And it is really hard. I have to say, we're a community college in many ways. You know, we are part of the community. We were formed to be of, with, and in community. So for us to not be able to have as much community engagement is really very difficult. So you better believe, as soon as we can, we will certainly let people know and be welcoming with open arms.
And I want to address a point that some listeners have raised about the new variants, one that seems to at least have been identified first in the UK, one first identified in South Africa. Some encouraging news today. Carl Bergstrom is one of the science writers I really like. He's a biology professor and a really smart science writer. And he writes that the news on this is encouraging. A new study looks at blood sera from patients vaccinated with the Pfizer vaccine and finds neutralizing activity comparable to that for combinations of key mutations in these new strains. It's not as strong a durability. In other words, there is some concern that, you know, we are sort of seeing an eventual erosion of what we could see in terms of immunity from these vaccines in the case of these new mutations, but we're not at a point where the new mutations are evading the effect of the vaccines. That is sort of, there's a caveat with that. Bergstrom goes on to basically say, time is of the essence to continue to get this vaccine rolled out, because what we don't want to do is play this waiting game where eventually there might be a mutation that can evade the immunity we get. Now, in that case, Pfizer and others have said they think they could sort of reprogram a vaccine within about 6 weeks, maybe even scale up production, but who knows? And so the bottom line is, the news so far has been decent in terms of the vaccine durability, but we know that we are seeing more cases in New York State. The governor said this week more than 40 cases of the UK variant in this state, and that means there's probably a lot more of it that we don't know about. So what we could see is more transmissibility. Even though the numbers are down right now, and I say down, they're still high, but they're down from their high. They're going in a better direction. What we don't want to see is those numbers reverse. And I want to ask our guests if that is something that is sort of top of mind, or do you feel like, you know, President Paul, could that derail your efforts to stay as much as you can in classrooms throughout the rest of this year?
Isn't it amazing how much we have learned in the last several months? It's really astounding. And of course, you know, we stay very close every day. We are staying close to every bit of scientific research that is coming out and really trying to learn along with the evolution of this virus. And we make adaptations as we need to in terms of our rules. So we are looking at these variants with concern. And it's one of the reasons why we are stepping up our guidance to, you know, again, the highest risk activity is dining. And so how can we help our students dine in a safer way? We had an outdoor tent at the beginning of the year, which will certainly come back in the spring weather. But for now, it is thinning out the dining hall, restricting the number of people that can dine together, having them further apart. But then also advising them that if they're sitting and they've done, you know, they're done eating and they're sitting and they're having conversation, wear a mask. That we know is very effective. So we're trying to help all of us in our community to know how to adapt to these changing circumstances and be as safe as we can.
Yeah, I'm going to the grocery store today, and for the first time, I will be double masking. Just based on what you're reading. And Kate Douglas, you want to add to that?
I was just going to talk about double masking. One of the things that we've been role modeling here on the campus this week as we're welcoming students back is that it's okay to double mask. We have some, we're not requiring any employees to come back. There are some who are back because they want to be teaching in some face-to-face. And we are encouraging them to think about double masking, that they're this is a race between vaccination and the variants, and we want the vaccinations to win, but we're doing that as quickly as we can in cooperation again with the county and the state. And so how do we keep each other safe while we do that? And double masking is something that we can think about.
And Jeff Renner.
Yeah, so our students are coming back right now for the 1st of February, like the other schools. And, you know, we want to make sure that we are not getting too relaxed. So we're not in the yellow or orange zone anymore, and that's great. But it doesn't mean this is over and there's vaccinations coming. That's great as well. This is not over. And with the looming these other variants, it's something we have to stay very, very careful about. So we're not going to start relaxing what we're doing on campus. The dining bit is we've had similar challenges. What we've ended up doing is converting several really large sort of rooms that we'd normally use for events into dining spaces with tables spread out and setting up for chairs. And really, they're only for dining. So when students are in there, they are eating. When they are not, when they are done, they except for certain times, they end up leaving. So we exactly, as mentioned, we don't want to have people sitting around chatting with their masks down. I think it's confusing to students, and it's, of course, confusing. Why is it okay to be sitting at a table with my friends and eating when I can't do that at other times? And the fact is, the only reason we are letting them take their masks off is because there's no way, no other way to be able to eat. So it is confusing, but we want to make sure students are not doing the dining style, sitting with their masks off in other situations. Mm-hmm. That's a real critical thing.
And as we get ready to wrap here, I'll start with Jeff on this email from a listener named Tom, who, I mean, I think it's important to continue to hear criticism as well. And, you know, listeners know I've said many times, I'm glad I'm not in the position of our guests. I think it's a very, very hard task what you're all trying to do. And I have a lot of appreciation for it. But, you know, let's air out some of the criticism. And Tom says, the participation in today's discussion maintains that the quality of education has not declined. That is not true. There's no way that students are getting the same quantity and quality of education. My son is not getting the interaction with faculty that your panel asserts. The only thing that has not declined is the tuition. So Tom feels that this has been, you know, maybe glossed over too lightly. And Jeff Renner, what would you say to that?
Well, so it kind of goes back to what I mentioned earlier about our faculty have gone back to the drawing table to try to understand what is it they're trying to do in their classrooms and how can they do it in a way that is using different tools. And it, you know, we believe we are, you know, our faculty are doing a really good job of trying to make sure that what the students are supposed to get out of the classes, they're actually getting out of the classes. We have encouraged faculty to continue to have office hours, even if it's not in person, over Zoom, so that they can have personal interactions with our students. I agree that this is a challenging time, but we are certainly working our best to try to create the opportunities that our students really come to expect by being part of our universities.
Okay. Kate Douglas at MCC.
Well, I would say that your listener has a point. Not all students learn in the same way, and not all of our students are the strongest swimmers in our remote learning sea. And so at Monroe Community College, we've also always had a very robust collection of wraparound services to help students succeed, but we have really bolstered them up. And sometimes with the convenience and the privacy possible with technology, the one-on-one is possible in a way that isn't as easily accomplished for some students. So I really want to give a shout out to our foundation that has stepped up in a huge way in terms of financially supporting students through these holistic wraparound services that we're talking about. We have provided over $115,000 worth of grants to students for things like housing and transportation and technology and food insecurity to help them succeed in the classroom. And it makes an absolute difference. And we've been able to quantify the difference that it makes between the students who receive those services and the students who don't. So I'm not going to disagree with your listener that it is different and that some students definitely prefer and learn better in different modalities. But, you know, we've been faced with an emergency. We're doing what we can in the emergency, and we're learning a lot, and we're supporting our students in new and different ways as a result.
All right, last 45 seconds, President Paul.
I certainly agree. We are in unprecedented times. There's no question. And we've had to pivot. We've had to be very ingenious about the ways in which we continue with our mission. And what I've seen here is a faculty and staff that care deeply about the students and each individual student. So one of the things we've done so much more of, although we always do a lot, is individual outreach to students and make sure that we are meeting students where they are. And I am seeing that happen every single day here. It's really inspiring to me. So I appreciate very much the challenges of this time, and I also very much believe in people who are so dedicated to education that they are making it work.
Too early to say that next fall you expect to be fully operational as normal. President Paul, real quick, too early, or is that the expectation?
That is the expectation.
Okay. Kate Douglas, next fall, more like a normal operation is the expectation?
We're aiming for a very robust campus presence in the fall.
Okay. Jeff Renner at University of Rochester?
We are certainly hoping so.
That is fair enough. Again, I want to thank our guests, Jeff Renner, Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences and Engineering at the University of Rochester. Jeff, thanks for making time for the program.
Thank you.
Kate Douglas, President of Monroe Community College. Thank you, Kate.
Thank you, Evan. It's a pleasure.
And the president of Nazareth College is Beth Paul. Our pleasure having you, Beth. Thank you.
Many thanks.
All right, more connections coming up in just a moment.